Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Hey friends, and welcome to the Happy Hour with Jamie Ivey podcast. I'm your host, Jamie, and I'm so glad you're here. Each week on this show, I invite a friend to join me, and we chat about the big things in life, the little things in life, and everything in between. You guys, we have a show I've been waiting to have a conversation about for a long time. Today on the show is Tish Harrison Warren. Now, if you are around in 2021 and you follow me on Instagram or you listen to the podcast, I guarantee you, you heard me talk about her book, Prayer in the Night. I read that book in that fall and it became so dear to me and one of the best books I read that year. In fact, I think I declared it the best book I read all year, and so did some other people who are smarter and have a lot more influence than me. So I've been wanting to talk to Tish forever. She's really good friends with Esau McCauley, who you know has been on the show before. We love Esau. I think Esau put in a good word for us. So Tish lives in Austin. She came down to the studio. We have such a great conversation today. The show's a little bit longer, but I think it's okay because we had a great conversation. And honestly, you know the truth, I could have talked to her for a whole nother hour. We talk a lot today about her book, Prayer in the Night. We talk about grief. We talk about suffering. And I just want to say, we say this a lot in the show, but like all of us have grief in our life right now. And so we're not going to play the game of saying whose is bigger, whose is less. This show is so encouraging. I cry a couple of tears in the show explaining to her one of my favorite parts of the book. And so, gosh, go get this book, you guys. It's called Prayer in the Night by Tish Harrison Warren. It came out in 2021 and it is such a great, great, great book. Today we talk about it a lot. And without further ado, here's my new friend. I'm going to call her that. My new friend, Tish Harrison Warren. Tish, welcome to the Happy Hour.
Thank you for having me. It's fun to be actually with you.
Well, it is so fun to have you here on the Happy Hour. And I need to say this for the listeners and for you too. Whenever I have people on the show that I have fallen in love with their work and then they sit in front of me or I sit across the screen from them, I feel giddy and honored. And so I feel that way about you being here.
Thank you.
So I need to say that I read your book, Prayer in the Night. It came out in 2021. Mm-hmm. Okay. I read it in 2021. At the end of the year, I declared it the best book I read all year.
Wow.
And then it wasn't too long that I think Christianity Today declared it the best book of the year.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Well, it got book of the year.
I threw in the best. But literally, when I saw that, I was like, I want everyone to, I found the best book of the year, you guys. And so I read your book in 2021 along with some friends, and it just hit me in really, really great needed spaces. Mm-hmm. And so then my friend Lindsay, who works here, had already told me about it. And so then I went back and I read Liturgy of the Ordinary. And so I am now trying to go through everything that you read, everything that you've written.
Thanks.
And so I'm glad you're here.
Yeah, I'm so glad to be here.
So glad. Okay, so we were talking before. Well, first of all, introduce yourself, because I want everyone to know from your mouth who you are and what you do.
My name is Tish Harrison Warren, and I do all kinds of things. I'm an Anglican priest.
You do a lot of things, I've learned.
Yeah. I'm an Anglican priest. I'm a writer. That's my primary gig right now. I write a weekly newsletter for the New York Times on faith in public discourse and private life. Okay. And I am an author of a couple of books and write occasionally here and there for other things as well. And I have three kids, a 12-year-old, a 10-year-old, and a 3-year-old.
Busy stuff, busy stuff.
Yeah, so I'm tired.
Because you have a lot going
and
on.
And I'm so glad to be here. I might just stay after the podcast to sit in a quiet
room.
We're going
to go home. There's a couch here. I got a blanket for you.
Yes.
Take a nap.
That's actually why I came.
good. Take a nap. I want to just back up for a second and talk about something that we were talking about right before we started recording. And I said, wait.
Yes.
Tell me when I'm recording. So you asked me, which of those two books did I like the best? Prayer mm-hmm. in the Night or Liturgy of the Ordinary? Mm-hmm. And I told you, Prayer in the Night. Mm-hmm. And then you proceeded to tell me what?
Well, I asked you what your Enneagram number was.
Yes, and I'm an Enneagram 6. Everyone yeah. that listens knows.
So people should know, listeners should know, I'm not, there's some folks that are like super into the Enneagram, and I'm not, mm-hmm. like I don't even know my number.
I'll tell you by the end what your number is.
Yeah,
I'm
well,
just kidding. That's it's totally not allowed.
It's between two things, and I just think I'm both. And I know you're not. That's not how it works, but I think I just am. But anyway, so but my kind of operations manager assistant, who's wonderful, and has sort of developed this like completely untested, right. unproven
yes.
theory uh-huh. that different Enneagram numbers prefer different books of uh-huh. mine. So,
and do a lot of sixes fall under Prayer in the Night?
So Prayer in the Night is beloved of, you know, so I need to say this. IVP marketing would be sad, but all Enneagram numbers should buy both books.
Yes.
And all people across the Enneagram spectrum have enjoyed both books.
Yes.
So it's not like you hate one.
Totally.
I mean, it's not,
yes.
Yeah. It's not like, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. Twos hate Prayer in the Night
right.
or something. But typically, fours and sixes, sometimes eights, love Prayer in the Night.
That's so interesting.
And ones and twos really love Liturgy of the Ordinary. And then the others, like 3, 5, 9,
yeah.
7, I actually don't have data
yeah.
on.
So, I love your, is this
so
like
I don't
a little fourth
know.
Grade science experiment?
Yes. I have no idea. This is an unscientific
yeah.
study. So, I mean, I love both
mm-hmm.
books.
Mm-hmm.
You can, if you've written books, you love them both
mm-hmm.
all. It's like children.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I can't pick a favorite one
yeah.
in that sense. But Liturgy of the Ordinary was my first book, and it was so it was just so exciting
mm-hmm.
to get to write a book, and so there's like a first love
yeah.
kind of first crush
uh-huh.
Element to that and it really launched my career. I mean, it did much better than we were expecting, because I was essentially unknown
mm-hmm.
And so I'm always very grateful for that
mm-hmm.
book. And in term, I mean, I think Prayer in the Night is a better book.
Mm-hmm.
It's different in the sense that if Liturgy of the Ordinary is kind of first love,
mm-hmm.
Prayer in the Night is like when it's gotten really hard,
yep.
when love has gotten really hard
mm-hmm.
and figuring out how do you kind of keep going.
Yeah.
And so in that sense, it's an older book
yeah.
it's a book that feels, they both feel really authentic
mm-hmm.
in the sense that I was trying to really come out of where
yeah.
I was, and they both deal a lot with my own struggles. I don't know how you would write without writing
it
about
being
your
for
struggles.
Yourself, right.
But there's something that's more kind of hard won, I think, in some ways. I mean, that book, Prayer in the Night, about killed me to write, and it was a hard, hard book to write, and it was pretty painful to write
yeah.
in moments. And so, not that Liturgy of the Ordinary was a walk in the park, because it was
but
a
it
new project.
But it feels like Prayer in the Night was like you had to go deep into some deep soul places and grief, and
uh-huh.
going back and visiting grief, I think, is like so exhausting,
right?
And so,
yep,
you're pouring
right.
yourself out.
So I've said this, I think, elsewhere, but you know, when I got the idea for Prayer in the Night, I was actually on a writing kind of, I was, a writing retreat mm-hmm. is too fancy. Like when it was, when I had very small kids, and when you're a writer with small kids, some, it is not uncommon if you have very kind friends that if they, some friends of mine were going out of town. So they were like, do you want to come like sleep at our house overnight and work?
Yeah.
And so I went to write a different book that was much more sort of like doctrinal and, you know, because I don't know, it's more, I don't want to say it was more theological, but it was more sort of straightforwardly mm-hmm. theological. And this book, the idea of Prayer for the Night came and like just wouldn't leave me alone. It was like this cat that followed me home and like would not, like once it was there, it was like, this book has to be written.
Yeah.
But I did not want to write it. And I told God, I had three reasons that I did not want to write
what
it.
Were they?
Oh, do you want me to say all three? Uh-huh. This could be a long answer.
Well, I'm just trying to know what it was that you were not willing to write.
One of them, I'm happy to tell you all three. Depends on how long of an answer you want. But the one that I was bringing up, because it kind of relates uh-huh. to what you were saying, is that, you know, this was 2018, sort of, I can't remember when. It was like middle to end. I remember the weather was really nice. So it was like spring or summer mm-hmm. 2018. So it was about a year after these events, the events that kind of the book starts mm-hmm. with. And I was just beginning to kind of heal.
Yep.
And it felt like I was just beginning to like breathe again mm-hmm. or be able to like, I don't even know if I was at a place of like joy and belief again, but it was a place where I could like maybe think that could come again, mm. you know? And I don't get into this deeply in the book, not because I was avoiding it, just because it was too much, but our like all of the events that I kind of talk about in the book were like really hard on our marriage.
Yeah.
And I was just, we were just that, there was a lot of healing happening mm-hmm. or we were in counseling and there was healing. So it was like things were just starting to kind of heal a little bit. And it felt like, oh Lord, I do not want to go back and have to look at all this. Like I don't want to have to go back and feel all this again.
Yep.
Like I felt it. I'm ready to like, can I just write a book about, I don't know,
something that
10
doesn't
steps to a joyful life.
Yes. Yes.
Something.
Yeah.
Or something, you know, it just felt like, oh man, that's a dark place mm-hmm. to have to walk back into.
Yeah. If you don't know it, guys, I'm a Texas girl through and through. I've lived here most of my life. I was born here and I love traveling. Here's why I love traveling throughout Texas, because it has a vast landscape of cultures, regions, destinations, and activities, which means there's an infinite number of different travel experiences. And no two travelers are exactly alike, and it means that no two trips should be either. If you're a beach person, well, you can have fun under the sun with Texas's 350 miles of coastline. If you're more of a rugged vacation type, there are campgrounds, hiking trails, and state parks galore. And foodies cannot get enough of Texas's world-famous barbecue and Tex-Mex. Enjoy live music, visit internationally recognized art museums, and check out thrilling cowboy experiences. And now, Travel Texas offers a one-of-a-kind online trip builder that allows users to generate a custom, visually led trip matched to their unique interest. Guys, come visit my state. Visit traveltexas.com/get-your-own to get the only trip to Texas that matters. Yours. That's traveltexas.com/get-your-own.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
That doesn't surprise me because... Mm-hmm. I think anytime you've been through something, unless you're writing in the middle of it, which
I would say majority of people are not. I mean, there might be journaling or whatever, but like mm-hmm. no one's trying to like write a book in the middle of their grief normally. You know, they're just like trying to get through the day. Mm-hmm. And then to have to go back and enter into spaces that you already left, it's super, super. Not yeah. only is it difficult, to me, it's plain exhausting. Totally. And you're literally just yeah. like, because you feel all the feelings over again and the yeah. feelings that you already dealt with and that you already went through.
Yeah. But what I found in the process of writing the book is that I actually hadn't really dealt with that. There were certainly things I had, and like I said, I was in counseling, but the central sort of struggle mm-hmm. that I bring to the book, I had not really faced. And that is, it's in the second chapter. So this struggle is the silver thread in some mm-hmm. ways through the book, but particularly in the second chapter, there's this part where I say, I tell this story about my pastor Hunter, who says we cannot trust God to keep bad things from happening to us, which I heard in a sermon in college. And I knew that, but there was some sense of like, I don't, mm-hmm. are we allowed to say that out mm-hmm. loud? And so I write in the book, so if we can't trust God to keep bad things from happening to us, how do we trust God at all? And when I write pretty much every day, and I had nothing else to say. Mm-hmm. I wrote that sentence, and it was like the sentence of my soul at the moment.
There it was.
It was like the question, yeah. And I had no answer. So I sat there for another maybe 10 minutes, and I was like, I don't have the next sentence. And so I closed the computer and I didn't come back to the computer for like over a week. Because I just was like,
what do I do?
I don't know the answer. Yeah. I have a book contract signed.
That's supposed to have the answer.
And so it really took me I wrote about 80,000 words and then, which is a crazy long book. Mm-hmm. And then I whittled it down to about 40,000, mm-hmm. which is a normal size book. Mm-hmm. And wrestled with that over a period of about a year and a half. And that's what it took for me to actually be able to reckon with how mm-hmm. does one trust God.
Yeah.
So it's funny because the other book I was going to write that I was drawn to is a fine book to write, and maybe I'll write it again
maybe
someday.
One day.
But it was much more sort of, like I said, doctrinal. Mm-hmm. And I honestly think I was using theology to avoid the central question of my life, which was how do you trust God? And that was all wrapped in loads of grief, loads of distrust, loads of doubt and unbelief. And I was sort of like avoiding the question, maybe even avoiding the question with a book on theology, right? And so that dare to kind of like, this is the book, I think it was because, you know, the Lord was sort of after me actually facing the question I didn't want to face.
I wonder, you said you were avoiding that question like with theology.
Mm-hmm.
And that sentence got me thinking, like, we all do this. It may not be theology.
Right.
It could be something else. And sometimes I think there are moments when I can have a good theology of something, but I don't, push comes to shove, when I haven't walked through that, it gets a lot harder. Like, you know, like I'm trying to say, like, if I were to lose a spouse to death, like my grief would have to come into play, and the theology, although it would be there, it couldn't take over for my grief. Does that make sense what I'm saying?
It totally makes sense. Yeah. I mean, I'm super for theology. I'm super for wrestling with doctrine. And in some ways, we can't quite process anything or any emotion without it.
Yeah.
Because any emotion we bring questions to, like, I mean, even ought we listen to our emotions? That's mm-hmm. that is a deeply like theological, philosophical mm-hmm. question. Like, you know, if you lose a spouse, like, is there hope in the midst of that?
Yeah.
So there is some sense where, I mean, I just think, I mean, Liturgy of the Ordinary, like, pouring a cup of coffee is theological. So you can't get away from that.
Right.
At the same time, I think there's something in what you're saying that we can think of theology primarily as this cognitive exercise. And so I do see this, even as a pastor, I see this where people in grief can sometimes go to, like, the answer mm-hmm. or want, you know, the sort of, I don't know, the kind of, like, pat or acceptable kind of Christian response. And it's a way, actually a reviewer of my book said this. They said, it's made me realize that I use theology to cork my sense of grief.
Wow.
To quiet my sense of my emotions of it anger.
We feel like if we show those emotions, then we maybe don't trust God. Or maybe God isn't good.
Right, right. Yeah, or maybe God will leave us in the midst of it.
Yeah.
I mean, I think some of those emotions for me were coming because I didn't trust God. But the response to the, I mean, God is not surprised by that. It is hard to be a human being and to live your life trusting God.
Yep.
And so I think the response to that isn't to sort of, like, pretend we have the right answer or pretend that we're in a different spot. But, I mean, look at the psalmist all the time. He's like, where are you?
Right.
Why
have you forsaken me?
Yes, why have you forsaken me? How long, O Lord? How long? And I was just reading this morning of, you know, the psalmist is reciting, like, you have done this in the past. You delivered these people and you have forgotten us. Like, what? I mean, can you?
Those
are real emotions. And I think a lot of if you brought that to, you know, many pastors, they would say, oh, don't, you know, the response of, like, God hasn't forgotten you, which of course God hasn't forgotten the psalmist, but there was something faithful in even expressing that, because remember, he's, like, expressing that God has forgotten him in a promise to God.
Right.
So he's practicing lament.
Lament, that's what I was going to say, and I think that's something that we struggle with.
Yeah. Definitely.
Definitely in this world. Yeah. You said this in your book. You said, but unless we make space for grief, so you're writing, probably learning this yourself. You said, but unless we make space for grief, we cannot know the depths of the love of God, the healing God wrings from pain, the way grieving yields wisdom, comfort, even joy. If you do not make time for grief, it will not simply disappear. Grief is stubborn. It will make itself heard, or we will die trying to silence it. Yeah. If we don't face it directly, it comes out sideways in ways that aren't always recognizable as grief. Explosive anger, uncontrollable anxiety, compulsive shallowness, brooding, bitterness, unchecked addiction. Grief is a ghost that can't be put to rest until its purpose has been fulfilled.
Yep.
Everyone takes a deep breath on that one. It's going to come out.
Yeah.
And did you find that? Because you just said, as you were journeying through writing this book, you had to even go back and acknowledge some things that you hadn't dealt with. Did you find having to go through this as you were writing, this grief coming out, or were you just aware of how it had?
Oh, no. And still, I mean, I still
this is a, let's not act like we're both
all the time. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, there's all kinds of times now where I'm just, like, snapping at my husband or really, really anxious. And I have to sort of be like, what is underneath this?
Yeah.
I had a counselor who said, you know, underneath anger is typically sorrow or fear. And so but those both sorrow and fear are kind of vulnerable to feel and admit, and so anger can be a real it feels less vulnerable. And there's certainly not anything wrong with anger, but when I just feel like this kind of irrational anger, when I'm like, this is,
where did this come from, what
yeah,
is this
yeah, yeah. yeah. Or that it's just by coming out sideways, I just mean that it's like I'm reacting really unkindly or really impatiently, or that I still have to stop and be like, what is underneath this? Mm-hmm. What's the fear underneath this? Mm-hmm. What's the grief underneath this? And I'm I mean, I think I didn't grow up in a home that, like, was, you know, we didn't talk about grief. That mm-hmm. wasn't. And so I think, yeah, I certainly saw it and was learning through the writing of this book, but also I just see it everywhere. Yeah. I mean, I think I say this in the book, but my husband, anger has always been something that he's sort of struggled with. He was very into, like in college and kind of before and after his like conversion to Christianity, he was super into punk rock.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something really, really beautiful and good about that. But he would say like some of it was just he just had a lot of aggression.
Yeah.
And, you know, the mosh pit. I mean, people would just like wail on each other, mm-hmm. just beat each other up at shows. And he just thought that was the best, you know, mm-hmm. like it was just so it was interesting. I mean, of course, that affected our marriage in all kinds of like not great ways. Mm-hmm. And we both have some of that. It's not just him.
Yeah.
I mean, we brought all kinds of baggage into our relationship. But as we've both kind of had to face that,
mm-hmm.
you know, what came out, and again, I said this in the book, but like, he just when he started dealing with that, he just cried
because there was so much sorrow
the
in there.
Yeah, I mean, just sometimes he would not even know. I mean, I think it was just his father passed away when he was 11, and you know, he just had some stuff that he had never really grieved,
mm-hmm.
and he cried enough where this one sweet woman in our church like brought him a gift wrapped, and it was handkerchiefs.
Oh, because she'd seen him crying
because,
so much.
Well, because he also is a priest,
uh-huh.
so he would cry when he just started where like all his sermons he started crying. He was just crying all the time.
Yeah,
in his sermons, in his teaching, in his worship, and it just was such a sign. It was so sweet, mm-hmm. and it was such a sign of healing. It felt like it was like something in him was tapping into something really that had been waiting to be heard for a long time.
Yeah.
And I just think that's true. I think Martha Nussbaum she's a philosopher that talks about emotions as, she calls them hot cognitions,
mm-hmm.
meaning they communicate, some cognitions are, you know, thoughts, but that she talks about how we can sort of think about rationality as the thing that speaks truth, and emotions as sort of just feelings, mm-hmm. you know, or something less mm-hmm. than. But that she would really say emotions are communicating something really true.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I think David Foster Wallace says, this is one of my favorite quotes, he says, "The truth will set you free, but not until it's finished with you." And I think that's what I'm getting at with the mm-hmm. grief thing, is like the grief in our life is saying something actually true.
Yeah.
And the only way to kind of get on the other side of it is to go through it.
Yeah.
Like you can't
to
you
listen
can't
to it
go
and deal
around
with it. Yeah.
And because it's a tutor, it's you're needing to really learn what it has to say.
Yeah.
So
I think that is why, Enneagram aside, I resonated with the book Prayer in the Night so much, is because, I mean, I look back and 2021 was a hard year for me emotionally, finding out some grief that I hadn't acknowledged. And so it was almost like I was
I mean, I wrote this book before COVID.
Yeah.
So
yeah. And then
like
we're
the
all
the world was falling apart when the book came out.
Yes. And so there's a part in the book, and I already told you I forgot my book at home. And so I hope I don't mess this up, but you can help me with it. There's a part towards the end, and speaking of crying, where you talk about Jesus taking all of our tears.
Mm-hmm.
And I could cry right now thinking about it, because that part of the book, I want you to talk about it. I read that for the first time and I thought, wow, he cares and he's going to like make all this right and it's going to be okay. Mm-hmm. And I've gone back to that part several times since my first reading of the book in moments of wondering, like, Jesus, do you care about this sorrow that I'm walking through? Mm. And so I want you to, if you can, to expand on that. And I apologize, I don't have the book or I would have read from it. But just talk about that idea of, like, Jesus, he's going to take care of us. And mm-hmm. and he's going to take all of our tears, just like Scripture says. And you said it so beautifully in the book.
Yeah, I probably said it better in the book than I can now. I'm a better writer than I am a talker, for sure.
Well, everyone needs to go read it, because look at how I'm crying about it. And I don't even have it in front of me.
But I don't totally remember. I don't read my books once they're out, because I've read them too much.
I completely understand that.
I think it's in the chapter on weeping. And
it's at the very last page of whatever chapter it is on the left side of the book.
I think it's the chapter on weeping. And I talk about the scripture that talks about how God will wipe away our tears. And I say, like, you know, okay, that could just be metaphorical, that there will not be tears. But what if it's not? You know, what if... before we enter into, like, the fullness and the glory of the new heavens and new earth and all is set right, what if we get to we don't just run into that, but we stop and we honor all the losses that got us there, all the broken places, and that we kind of, really, I think for the first time, looking back with the presence of God, God shows us our story with all of the places we've been deeply wounded, all the places we've deeply wounded others, all the twists and turns and things that did not make sense at the time. And we cry with, we get to weep with the source of life. You know, we get to weep with our Savior. And then God wipes away our tears, you know, that only by actually crying and facing it can God wipe away our tears. But I also think that God ultimately is the only one who can wipe away mm-hmm. our tears in a way that is, like, actually healing.
Yeah.
That actually in that moment there will be healing that we long for, and we're not going to be able to gin up on our own. So I think that folks can read that as, like, okay, we just won't have any more tears. We'll just pop and be just totally happy. But what if something about wiping mm-hmm. away implies that there are tears, right?
Yeah.
It's not just...
And there's an action.
It's not just, like, automatic happiness. Mm-hmm. And I say in the book, like, I don't know. You know, there's a holy, hopefully, imagination kind of happening here. But I do think that it's hard for me. It almost feels like heaven, or however you want to talk about that, resurrection, the new heavens and new earth, would be a kind of escapism if there's not a time to be really honest about the hard things, and to sort of grapple with God about those things. So I don't, of course, know what that will look like, but I think, you know, there's this other passage about God keeping our tears in the bottle. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It doesn't seem like if he cares enough to know the number of hairs on our head and to keep our tears in a bottle, that all of that would just be ignored.
Yeah.
It feels like part of redemption will be facing that with the only one who can actually heal mm-hmm. and can actually see the whole story. Mm-hmm. I mean, Jesus in his resurrection still had scars, right? And so those places, I think, of scarring in our life, and I mean that bodily, but also just spiritually and emotionally, they have to be addressed. They can't just be ignored.
Yeah.
And so I think whatever redemption looks like, it's not just going to be like a, I don't know if you've, one time in my life, first time and the last time, went with my mother, wanted to take our kids on a Disney cruise, and it was insane.
Yes.
But you walk on a Disney cruise and everyone's like, yay, he's like screaming and cheering and they're singing songs. I'm not sure that's what it will be like going into heaven. I mean, maybe this is just because I don't like Disney cruises. And so but it feels like there's got to be some sort of acknowledgement of what Jesus actually has saved us from.
Yeah.
You know, the brokenness of the world.
Yeah.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
When I read it, and if you're watching this on YouTube, you can see that I still get emotional, even you talking about it. Remember when I read it? When I read it, to me, what it did to me to have this holy imagination, as you said, was to imagine. So when I feel sad here in this body, on this earth, my theological knowledge tells me that God is with me and he hasn't left me and he is for me. All those things that we know to be true. When I used my holy imagination when I read that, I imagined God being with me, like literally with me, Jesus looking at me and letting me weep.
That's beautiful. Yeah.
And him being there, touching me, holding me. And again, I don't know if that's what it's going to be like. but it really did something to me. And it almost made me trust even more in the here and now. Like, I really do, like we talked about already, my theological stance, I can get that. I know God's with me in the heart. I know he's here, all those things. But that part about weeping one last time with God before there's no more weeping and letting him wipe all my tears away, it made me love God more.
Oh, that's beautiful.
And so.
It's beautiful. It's, I think, I don't totally remember that moment, but I think that I do. I mean, one of the, first of all, thank you. That's beautiful to say. I would love if things I wrote made people love God more. So that's great. Thank you. But also, it's one of the things that makes me love kind of, it's why I'm a writer. It's one of the things that makes me love doing this is that I remember this. So we lived in this very small house in Pittsburgh, and we had three kids in it. We had two kids, and I was pregnant. So the only quiet place to work was like this, the third floor of our house in this little corner. It was not beautiful. It's not like, I know there's, you know, pictures of like professional writers, you know, writing sheds, and it's beautiful. Yeah. And this was not that. This was like dark and sad.
Yes.
And like I was working on a card table.
Yeah.
And my husband is a painter and does icons. So there was like paint and like turpentine. Like there was like chemicals around.
Yes.
So whatever. We use the same space. So and I'm writing that, and a lot of times when I write, there's sort of like things that I didn't know I knew or hopes that I didn't know I had, or things are coming out of me that are not. So it wasn't like I sat down and thought, oh, here's an interesting insight on this biblical passage. Uh-huh. I mean, I'm sort of writing this. And I cry when I do it. I'm crying. Not all the time. I mean, I write for a living. A lot of it is just like deadlines. And
exactly.
But there are these moments where I think, especially with this book, because I was wrestling with these things. I really think writing, the best writing comes out of things that people are, that writers themselves don't get or are wrestling with, trying to get, learning kind of on the growing edge of their lives. And so that was one of those passages where I, through that, was, I think I wept when I wrote it too. I think I was thinking maybe, you know, maybe this is a better hope than I, you know, first thought.
Yeah.
And in a very similar way of like, what would it be like? What would it be like to actually be with God? To be in the presence of Jesus and to be able to acknowledge the pain of my own life, like in specific terms, like, you know, this happened to me when I was 11. This, what about this moment when I was 15? You know, like to be able to kind of weep with the one who loves me most, you know, that's, I think that I come to the page with these same sort of longings too.
And you said, we were talking about crying with your husband, and it, like, it's a vulnerable state to be so emotional that you cry and shed tears. And I think about that too, like the ability to be completely vulnerable with Jesus, which I want to be that way anyways. But I mean, let's just be real. There, we have this relationship with a spirit, and there's no one sitting in front of us with a physical body.
Right.
And so just to imagine that vulnerability of, like, seeing Jesus, it was just way too much for my feeble little brain to try to figure out. But I think that another thing about this book that is so good is, like, grief is not, like, just some people. You know, like, you talk about, like, jokingly about the difference in the two books. But really, like, everyone is going through grief. Everyone's going to have grief. It is coming for us all. We are living with it. It is here to stay, my friends.
Yeah, it's funny you bring that up, because that's the second read. Maybe we're just going to
kind of go through the three reasons.
All three.
This is like your own little post-therapy session.
But the second reason, I was like, so the first reason was like, I don't want to go back
there. Yeah.
And the second reason was like, I can't write a book on suffering. Like, my life hasn't been bad enough. Like, it.
You had this idea that it could be worse.
It could be worse. And I mean, I've read beautiful books on suffering. Mm-hmm. There's whole genres of Christian books on suffering, and some by dear friends of mine, and they're about, like, the worst things that can happen in life. Like, but they're by and large written by friends of mine who've lost children, which is kind of my nightmare.
Yeah.
Like my friend Cameron Cole. He wrote a book called Therefore I Have Hope. It's a great book, but and it's written after his 3-year-old son died in the middle of the night. And so I was thinking of Cole, or this great book about suffering. But he lost his mother and his wife and his daughter in a car accident all together, all at the same time. So and, you know, of course, something like Lament for a Son, which Walter Storff's book about losing a son. So I just felt like, you know, I haven't lost a child. I have through miscarriage, but that's common, you know. So and 1 in 4 pregnancies and a miscarriage. And so, you know, it felt like I had lost my dad. I'd lost a parent. But all of us will lose a parent.
It's like the natural, quote unquote, natural progression.
If we live long enough, I'd moved across the country. But a lot of people have experienced loneliness, and I had, you know, 2 pregnancy losses, and 1 was a second trimester. It was a hard. They were all hard losses, but it was. I knew this baby. You know, I'd seen this baby so many times, but. But still, it felt this is fairly common. And so I was like, Lord, I can't write about suffering. It will seem like it'll just seem whiny. Yeah. You know, it'll just seem, it could be worse. You know, I heard my father's voice in my head, like, it could be worse. And that ended up actually being sort of a part of the book, I think kind of a gift of the book, mm-hmm. is saying that we can think of grief. I certainly could think of grief as this phenomenon that happens to this certain group of people,
right?
Like, mm-hmm. to this kind of people who particularly suffer, mm-hmm. and they write books on suffering, and they kind of report to us, you know, that
in case we ever get into their club,
right? Yep. Exactly. And it felt like, no, this is exactly why you should write this book. Is that first of all, I realized something being common doesn't make it hurt less. That's when you're good. Going through
That's
it.
Good. Yeah.
Yeah. And but second, and I am not, I want very clear, I'm not saying that grief is all equal. I am not saying that suffering is all equal. It's not. I mean, there are folks that suffer more deeply than others.
Yeah.
There, and my life in so many ways is just wrapped around with privilege. Mm-hmm. And yet, even for the sort of the best of lives, grief is part of it for all of us. And that grief is real.
Yeah.
And knowing that other people have grief, or knowing that other people have it worse, it can become a way of not actually looking at your own grief.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that I think we cannot know God in the way that God has made us to know him, unless we meet him in pain, in the places of grief, mm-hmm. of our life. I think he's waiting for us in the places of grief in our life. And we will not meet him there if we if we shame ourselves for feeling grief because it's not as bad as others. Yeah. It's not as bad as other people. And so the second reason was sort of like, I can't write this book because I haven't gone through the worst thing I can imagine. And part of the book, I mean, I talk in the book about sort of grief being like the white noise in every life. Like, it's just there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of, I mean, it's even, I mean, there's been moments of real beauty in my life, goodness in my life, where grief sort of rears its head.
Yeah.
And I still sense a sense of loss or a sense of grief, or even just that life is fragile,
yep.
and that this really lovely moment can't last, mm-hmm. you know, or won't last. And so I just think none of us get through life without grief,
mm-mm.
and without loss, like very real loss. And so making grief like the property of, of just a small mm-hmm. group of people, or something that you have to kind of earn the right to be sad, actually just diminishes the reality of what it is to be human. And I think robs us of ways that we could actually meet God in the pain that we have. So that was sort of my second objection to God that got knocked down.
Well, it's even like how you, when you said just now, like, we meet God in the midst of this grief, and I agree 100%. And then when you pair that with what you say in your book, that grief is like this white noise, it's constantly around us.
Mm-hmm.
I do think it has even just made me think just now, like, which ways am I avoiding God today?
Oh, that's interesting.
Because I'm not willing to acknowledge an emotion, face an emotion, deal with an emotion. I mean, if I think about just my day today, what is today? April 13th. Like, I have just been going from one thing to the next. But you're right when you say that there are things, if I were to stop and think, there are things that I'm grieving today,
mm-hmm.
whatever that might be. And what if I looked at that as an opportunity to meet God?
Yeah.
Instead of an opportunity to, like, I don't have time to feel sad, or I don't have time to think about that.
Yeah, right.
If you just flip that, I mean, I'm just thinking about my day today. I would have met with God a lot today, you know? But I mean, I think it's just encouraging, because there's nobody that's ever come on my podcast when we're discussing something that they've been through that has been difficult or hard, and it doesn't have to fall in that category of, like, the worst thing in the world. There's no one that hasn't, they all say the same thing, every single person. They say, I knew God more in that season, in that grief, than I ever had before. And there has to be something too, like meeting God in the midst of that. And the way that we're talking about it here, it's like that's available to us today.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, I talk about this. This goes, actually, I say this in Liturgy of the Ordinary. So I started, you know, I was wrestling with some of these same things there, is that I think that if we train ourselves, you know, I know, I proclaim, I would preach, I've been to seminary, that God meets us in suffering. But if we sort of train ourselves to say, okay, God meets us in suffering, and suffering is only the worst thing that ever happens to me, it's like we... it's like we're waiting
for the worst
to meet God. Whereas I actually think the only way that we're going to be able to sort of like embrace the presence of God in that darkness is if we sort of like practice on lesser things,
which is
and we kind of can miss God, I think, in ordinary suffering if we're always waiting. For if we go, okay, yes, if I get cancer, God will be there.
Right.
But God isn't there for me right now,
right,
as, you know, whatever, like a young mom who hasn't had sleep in 3 days because my kid has an ear infection, and I, you know, whatever, have a 3-year-old that's wanting my attention, and our freaking sink is backed up and won't work, and
there's something to grieve.
My husband, you know, whatever, like yelled at me, or I yelled at him, or and there's just this sort of like, okay, like that's a really ordinary bad day.
Yeah.
But if we don't learn to sort of meet God in that, then not only are we like missing out, I think, on encounters with God, but I also think we're sort of, how are we then going to sort of like turn around in our darkest moment if we haven't sort of
practiced it?
Yeah, practiced this in our ordinary lives.
Yeah.
And I think I knew, you know, I kind of was trained to look for God in suffering, but I always thought of that as catastrophe. And so I wasn't trained to look for God in kind of the ordinary suffering of a week. And so I think there's something lost, I think, in that.
Yeah. I think what you're saying is also we have to reevaluate what deserves grieving. Because there's this idea that, like, you grieve when someone dies. You grieve when you lost a job. You know what I mean? Like these big things like you're saying. But even as we're talking without giving any details, right before we started recording, my daughter calls me. She had a problem. She needed me. And I chose to stay here and interview with you and had someone else go help her.
Yeah.
I don't regret that decision. But even as we're talking, I'm like, oh, I could grieve that moment that I had to work instead of going to be with her.
Right.
And that is a moment that isn't big. Everyone's fine. It's not that big of a deal. Yeah. But I can acknowledge that and say, I feel a little sad that I didn't get to be the one to help her.
Yeah, totally. I totally get that and feel that. And I have been dealing, my daughter has faced some sort of like difficulty in school and some social stuff that's just hard. Very normal. She's in middle school, so very normal kind of, but some like bullying stuff and that kind of thing. And I think you're right. My first instinct was to sort of belittle it, to be like, oh, it's normal, you know, I don't grieve this. But I'm realizing like the reality that my daughter is going to suffer in this world and I can't rescue her from all of that is really it's really grievous to me. And the way that I know, I don't actually feel sad. My response as a mom is anxiety. How can I fix this? Well, the reality is I can't.
Right.
And anything that I stepped in and tried to do would be like a little neurotic and a little way. Like,
she would probably ask you to stop.
Oh my gosh. Yes.
Uh-huh.
But underneath that anxiety is just this deep grief that I do not want my kids to suffer. Yeah. I don't want them to suffer big, and I don't want them to suffer small. Mm-hmm. I want to rescue them from all of that. And as she gets older and older, I can't. Mm-hmm. I mean, even as a kid, and as a little kid. So part of this grief, like, that you felt with your daughter, that I'm feeling with my daughter about social stuff, or the made up mom who has the backed up sink with a kid with a ear infection. This touches on much bigger. Like, yes, we're grieving because people die. Of course, that is like true grief.
Yeah.
But the fact is, and before we die, there's lots of kinds of small suffering that we experience that is real. And that what I'm saying, I think, is like, to some extent, we are grieving death. Even in that, like, when the kid has an ear infection, you're grieving that there's sickness in the world that you can't stop, no matter how much you love this little person. Mm-hmm. And I've felt this at 3 a.m. No matter how much I love this person, I cannot take this pain away from them. And yes, they're going to probably survive. Mm-hmm. But eventually they're not. Mm-hmm. And feeling, I think that's like a little, I think there's a taste of that. I think there's the taste of
like our fragility, broken bodies.
Our fragility. And I talk in the book, this was a very helpful concept to me, about being vulnerable, which we can talk about vulnerability in terms of sort of like, I'm choosing to be like emotionally open or honest. That's a fine way of talking about it. That's not the way I use the term in my book. I talk about vulnerability as an unavoidable human condition. So you can be John Wayne and you're still vulnerable.
Right.
I mean, he's dead. Mm-hmm. So he experienced vulnerability in a way that I even have not yet. And that that word vulner is from Latin, is to wound. So it's able to be wounded. And all of us live able to be wounded. We all live vulnerably.
Mm-hmm.
And from before we're born, but when we are conceived until our dying day, the most kind of charismatic, happiest, you know, think of the person who's like, whatever.
Yeah.
They have like a great house and a great family and the Christmas card looks so good. Like, that person is able to be wounded every minute of their life.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean that physically, I mean that emotionally, I mean that spiritually. And I don't just mean wounded by other people, I mean by our own bodies breaking down, by the just the tragic nature of history. And we all live in that world. We all live in a world where we deeply know we're fragile. This is the way that we're different than like my dog or whatever. You know, I think that we experience that fragility. We know we're going to die, and that the people that we love are going to die. And so there is real grief around just being a vulnerable human being that's like honest. Mm-hmm. It's like honest about our state of who we are.
Yeah.
And that doesn't mean that there's not also like ecstatic joy. But just that we never stop being vulnerable.
Yeah.
And so some of our grief that you expressed about your daughter and about my daughter that I expressed about my daughter, there's their physical vulnerability, their social vulnerability, their emotional vulnerability that is painful to us as people who love them, as mothers, that we can't rescue them from that. And we can't rescue ourselves from that either. And so I think what I'm saying is these little things are actually tapping on something really big and really true about the human condition.
Right.
Like when your sink backs up and everything's falling apart, it's not just that you're sad about that.
Yeah.
It's that you're sad about the uncontrollability of the world that we walk through.
Yeah. And those little things, I mean, you're right, because we can see the massive things on the news or even our own personal lives. But those little things, it is this evidence that we are vulnerable humans walking with broken bodies to all of our eventual deaths. I mean, yeah. You know, it's all of us. That's what's coming for us. And that can bring grief up when you think totally. About it in the little yeah. things.
Yeah. And I mean, if people are listening, like, of course we have perspective. Like, of course we don't weep over our sink clogging up as we do over, you know, a loved one dying or even like horrific tragedy mm-hmm. in the world. And yet we're grieving the chaos. Mm-hmm. We're grieving the fall. Like yeah. it's what we're grieving. A lot of what I grieve a lot of times is not even the specific thing mm-hmm. as much as just that, like, the world is not how it is meant to be.
Yeah.
And we feel that. We mm-hmm. feel that every moment. And I think one of the things I love about the Christian story, part of the reason I'm still a Christian, and one of the things I love about the gospel, is it tells me that the feelings I feel that this is not how things are supposed to be, that this is not how the world is supposed to be, that that's not just like wishful thinking, that that's true, mm. that actually touches on true reality. Because if there is no God, if there is no redemption, if we weren't created for a place of beauty mm-hmm. and joy, then the world just is the way it is.
Yeah.
Like, it's, I mean,
there'd be nothing to grieve because this would be what it would be, right? Is that right. what you're saying? Yeah.
Well, I'm saying, yeah. I mean, the world, like, we live in a world where the strong prey on the weak. Mm-hmm. Like, you see this in nature.
Yeah.
Like, that it is the way things are.
Yeah.
And so Christianity frees me up to say, okay, it's the way things are, but it's not how things are intended to be.
Yeah.
And so the gap.
And how they will be.
Right.
You know, yeah.
And how they were.
Yeah, and how so they the were and how they will be.
Between how things are and how things are meant to be is that space of grief. Mm. That's what the grief comes from. And so it touches on something I believe that's really true. Mm-hmm. It's not just fantasy.
Yeah.
It's real mm-hmm. that we feel that.
And that's the space we're in. And so it's where we are. Tisha, I love this book because, I mean, we could talk about it forever and I could tell you how much I love it. You start the
book. Because it was the best book of 2021.
Because it was the best book of 2021, says Jamie Ivey and Christianity Today. I knew I was going to love it when in the introduction you said, when I was a priest who could not pray, and then you talk about how what yeah. led you to that. And I was like, okay, I can relate to this. This is where yeah. I have felt alone in the night. I want to ask you. Before I ask you what you're reading, I want to know what you're working on these days. Are you working on any projects?
Yeah, well, I mean, the main project that takes up my time in the week right now is that I write every week for the New York Times. So that takes loads of time.
Which, you guys, you got to go read it because I've been loving it.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Yes, please subscribe to the yep. Times and then you can opt into my newsletter and then it comes right to your inbox.
Yep.
Or you can also just read it online. It's on the main page too. So that takes a lot of time and energy, but I've also have a book coming out that we just did the final proofs mm-hmm. for. It's a very different project in that it's a smaller project. It's like I don't know. I think about it as like a watercolor instead
okay.
of an oil painting. But it's literally a smaller project.
Okay.
Like it is a half size book. So
Got it.
It is a shorter
uh-huh.
project. It's my husband and I wrote it together.
Awesome.
And it's on Advent, oh. the season of Advent.
Mm-hmm.
It's part of a series with InterVarsity Press.
Okay.
Called the Fullness of Time
Got it.
Series.
Mm-hmm.
And there were six of us, I think it's six, that came together and we each took
Part of the church calendar?
We each took part of the church calendar. And we're all like liturgical folks in some way. So it's Esau McCauley. He's the general
We're huge
editor.
Fans of Esau over
yeah,
here.
Yeah, me too. One of my best friends. So Esau did Lent. His book just came out actually a while ago with Lent. Wesley Hill did Easter. And then a guy, Emilio Alvarez, did Pentecost. And then we each have a book. And you can read them individually and buy them individually, but then they also will be sold as a like set, and it's like an everything you need to know about Advent. But I've been joking that it's like Advent for dummies, in the sense that like it'll just tell you, it's like those For Dummies book where like an intro to the whole thing. So it's like a theological exploration of it and a thematic, like emotional, but then it's also very practical. Like, here are some practices that you can do, and this is how you do them. Like,
I actually
explain, like, here's how you should fast. Like, here's an example. Like, if you haven't fasted before, here's some things to keep in mind. So it's in some ways it's kind of more practical than some of my books, but it will be a really good book for church groups to read together.
So it comes out like October, November.
I think it's September. Coming out in August.
Okay, good. Get us ready.
Way before Advent. Yeah. I don't know why. I guess they do that so people can read it and then decide like can have time to read it and decide if they want to read it in a group for churches and that sort of thing. But I like it. It's a cool book. And so that's my next one. It's a small book that is everything you need to know about the liturgical season of Advent.
It'll
be appealing, like, even if you don't keep Advent, because Advent is all about, like, waiting in darkness for light to come. It's all about waiting for the coming of Christ. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's about preparation for Christmas, but one of the points I make in the book is it actually historically is far more about waiting for Jesus to return.
Right, to come again.
And to set things right.
Yeah.
And so it's this, like we've sort of talked about today, it's this liminal space of like the already, the not yet. We've seen Jesus come, but things are still broken in the world. And so if that resonates, at the end of the day, I don't care if you practice Advent, but I think that Karl Barth, I quote this, says that what other season do we ever live in besides Advent?
Besides waiting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so that all Christians live in this place of Jesus has come and Jesus has not yet set all things right, and we're in that space. So it's a book about Advent, but I think it's
about
life.
As it is.
We live in Advent, yes, whether you know it or not.
When David was here, David Taylor came and started our Advent season. He gave us such a history lesson on Advent, and it was so good. I love when he comes in and gives us history lessons.
Yeah, David and I are at the same church now.
I love it.
Yeah.
So great. Okay, Tisha, I'd love to hear what you're reading, but today's What Are You Reading segment is sponsored by Taylor Joy Murray and her new book, Stop Saying I'm Fine, Finding Stillness When Anxiety Screams. If that doesn't go well with what we've talked about today, Tisha, I don't know what else. Okay, so Taylor has a new book out, and here's the question, guys. Are you more familiar with anxiety than you want to be? Maybe you've tried to pray and trust God more, but you still feel defeated. Author Taylor Joy Murray can relate. Stop Saying I'm Fine is written out of Taylor's own struggle to live well inside of a story where anxiety is a dominant theme. With practical insights and vulnerability, Taylor invites you to process the story behind your anxiety and discover, as she has, the stillness that you're looking for isn't as distant as it seems. Taylor, thank you for that. There's a shirt that my friends Amy Brown and Mary do from Shot Forward. And it says, I'm fine, I'm fine, everything's okay. And that's what it makes me think of Taylor's book. She needs that shirt. Stop Saying I'm Fine. What are you reading these days?
So right now on my bedside table I shouldn't feel dumb about this. I always
feel dumb.
This, but everyone is reading this
book. Okay, what is it?
And I am too. But I'm reading Beth Moore's memoir, All
Listen,
My Knotted
Tish,
Up Life.
In 2021, everyone was reading your book. See? Because it was the best book of the year.
And I do. It's been great. Her memoir is really
It's really
compelling.
Good.
Yep. So I'm just over halfway through.
Have you shed any tears? Are you a crier?
I am a crier.
Okay. I cried today when I was reading a book.
I don't know if I've shed tears. It is unusual for me to cry when I'm reading.
Okay, actually. Well, you're going to have to come back and let me know, report back, because I cried at the end of her book.
Oh, I haven't gotten
it yet. I'm just saying,
I would recommend it.
Like, yeah.
If
I highly recommend it.
And so That is one book I'm reading. I read a lot for my job, so I could tell you things I'm reading for my job. But that right now, that is the book. The books on my bedside table are not books I'm reading for my job.
Yeah.
They're the books I'm reading because I want to.
Yeah.
And I'm enjoying them.
Uh-huh.
And so that's the book that I'm reading that is like my... It would be wrong to call it my fun book because that's, although she is very funny in it.
Yeah.
But it's my my reading for leisure book.
It's a memoir. Yeah. You know, it's like someone's life. I love it.
And memoir is my favorite genre.
Mine too. Tell me what else I should read.
What are my favorite memoirs? Oh my gosh. I have too many. But I will give you some.
Give me some.
Have you read Lit by Mary Carr?
I have a long time. Well, it's been out a while. Like,
yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
A lot of the ones I'm going to tell you. Okay, keep going. My
yes,
so
yes. Uh-huh.
So that's one of my very favorites. I love The Long Loneliness by Dorothy Day.
You are the second person I've interviewed that's told me that. Okay.
It's such a great book.
Okay.
Those are some that come to mind. Esau Macaulay's coming out with a memoir.
He is?
Yes. Yes.
Is that public or am I getting insider scoop?
No, it's public.
Okay,
it's
good.
Public, yeah.
Good.
Yeah, I think you can pre-order it. Those are some. I know I'm going to walk out of here and be like, oh, I should have said.
You can send me. Tell them to me.
But, yeah.
Okay. I'll need to know if you cry at the end of Beth's book. This is a memoir that is not like any of the ones you listed. But have you read Matthew McConaughey's book, Green Lights?
I have not.
Okay. It's nothing like anything you just listed. I'm not even like, I wouldn't call myself like a Matthew McConaughey fan. Okay. Mm-hmm. I'm just like, he is who he is. He lives here in Austin.
Yes.
All the things.
Yeah.
I listened to it and he reads it and it was so entertaining.
His voices.
So great. I just wouldn't throw that out there.
Okay.
It's entertaining.
Okay. So in terms of pop culture memoirs, my favorite, this a few years ago, but have you read Jeff Tweedy's it's called,
I don't even know who that is.
Oh, he's the lead singer of Wilco.
I don't even know who that band is.
Oh, really?
I'm not a music
they're
person.
Great.
Okay.
But it's called, it's something like Let's Go. Maybe it's just called Let's Go.
Okay.
But in parentheses, it's like, so we can come back again.
Okay.
That's what it's called.
Okay.
It's so good. And he talks a lot about recovery in it because he became addicted to prescription drugs. I hope I'm not giving anything away. You should just
I bet you could Google that.
But like, I don't know if we're allowed to talk about our earlier conversation, but he was in recovery with all these people who had in some ways much worse lives than he did, and so he felt like he couldn't like talk about his own pain because like he wasn't. And one of the people who'd had kind of the roughest life got in his face and he was like, don't compare yourself to me, don't compare yourself to others, like you got to feel your own pain.
Wow.
You got to walk your own story. And it was so freeing to him. But it, I mean, he talks about it as this pivotal point in recovery. And so I have a whole hobby horse that I think that we have so much to learn from the recovery community. But one of it is like, your grief is your grief.
That's right.
Like, own it.
Yeah.
But he talks about this in the book. I can't remember if I read it before or after the book came out, but it's a great book.
Okay. Because you like pop culture, have you read Bono's new book?
Yes. Well, it is also on the bedside table.
Okay.
So I haven't read all of Bono's new book, but I've read maybe a fourth of Bono's book. Enough. Like, he's been through some sad stuff already.
I haven't finished it either. It's a book I'm listening to very slowly. I don't know why. But my husband read it, and he's like, it's one of the best books I've ever read. And
beautiful.
He loves Bono anyways.
So part of the reason I haven't finished it, I am reading it slowly, but then I was told by so many people, you have to listen to it on audiobook.
Because he reads it.
I don't listen to audio books very much.
Uh-huh.
I know that lots of people do.
Yeah.
But I don't. I'm just not in situations where I could very often. And so, but multiple people have been like, if you don't listen to any other book on audio, listen to this because they insert... Like, he'll talk about
clips.
A song, and then they'll play it.
Uh-huh.
They'll play part of it.
Yeah.
So I was reading it. I saw Bono and Bono, Brene Brown interviewed Bono mm-hmm. at the Paramount, and I was there.
There, okay.
And so if you were there, you got the book. So I got the book, like whatever, like before it came out, uh-huh. and I started reading it. And then I'm still reading it slowly, but I'm hesitating because I might actually get
go listen
audiobook.
To it.
Book.
I hear it's worth it. Yeah,
it's great so far. Yeah. Very sad.
Yeah,
but really, really pretty beautiful.
I love it. Mm-hmm. Tish, thanks for coming on the happy hour.
Yeah.
I have loved it. And thank you for your work. I'm so glad God gave you the gift of writing because we are all benefiting from it. And so thank you, thank you, thank you.
Thanks. Thank you so much.
Hey guys, I'm Story. Jamie's my mom. And if you stay till the end, and if you listen to the end, I have an announcement. It's pretty great, guys. Ready? Drum roll, please. Tomorrow's my mom's birthday!
The Happy Hour with Jamie Ivey is a production of Ivey Media Podcast. Executive produced by Jamie Ivey. Produced by Lindsay Sweeney. Edited by Angie Elkins. Show notes by Nikki Ogden. Art by Jen Jett Barrett. Original music by Matt Graham. And I'm your host, Jamie. Have a happy hour with a friend.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.